Sampradaya. Vishnu Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nirvasesis and Nivali Paskachade Satane Vande Hamshan Gurushi Utah Padakamanam Shri Gurun Vaishnavams Chas Rupam Sagujatam Sahagana Ravinatham Vitam Sam Sajiva Sadvaitam Sadhutam Kavijana Sarita Krishna Chaitanya Deham Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Ravitam Shri Vishakam. Sorry, we are a little late today. So I'm also giving this class over the internet. So we have a lot of people listening from all over the world. That's why I have my computer and my headphone here.
Is there a link available on the website?
Excuse me?
Is there a link available on the website?
Yes, there is, at esangha.org. So this is September 21st, 2013 in Honolulu, Hawaii, and this is part three of practical service. So far we've looked at service in a general way, how our original position is as a servant of Krishna. That's our Sanatan Dharma, to be a servant. And how when we come to this material world, we want to be a master. In fact, we evaluate our relationships by how much other people are serving us. If my wife serves me very nicely, she's a good wife. My husband serves me very nicely, he's a good husband. If my boss serves me very nicely, he's a good boss. We evaluate things in terms of how much am I the master instead of how much am I the servant. But the problem is we can never find happiness with being the master. It's not our position. We're not the master. So as we said, Krishna is the giver. Krishna is not the ultimate taker. Krishna is really the ultimate giver. Krishna is the ultimate giver as the benefactor, Suridam Sarvabhutanam, which Prabhupada translates as the benefactor of all living entities. Krishna is giving like this. Here's my blessings. So in this world, we try to imitate, and we also try to give like that. But in this world, when we do that, we become very unhappy. It's not our position. And we talked about in the beginning how anyabhilasi tasanyam ganakana anavritam anukulena krishna anushilanam, that this shilanam, which is what we're focusing on in these three parts, this active service, is explained by Jiva Goswami as outward action in terms of the body, the mind, and the words, and esoteric action in terms of affection and despair of the mind. These feelings of affection for Krishna and despair, when will I get Krishna? So this silanam is manifested as the 64 angas of bhakti, which is what we discussed yesterday. We had that list of the 64 angas, how the three most important were? Three most important of the 64 angas. They are? Accepting initiation, following instructions of guru, and accepting the guru. You've got to accept the guru, take initiation, follow the instructions. Those are the three most important. Why are those the three most important?
That's how spiritual life begins.
You can't do anything else without them. How are you going to hear? Who are you going to hear from? The sky? Your own mind? The talk show host on the television? Who are you going to hear from? You have to accept who's your authority that you're going to hear from. And you make a commitment. So everything else flows from that. Therefore, the three most important. And the five most potent? Worshipping, deity, chanting, yes?
Hearing Bhagavatam.
Holy place, and associating with devotees. And then we read through the list in terms of also hearing, chanting, remembering, right? Serving the lotus feet, and we talked about what each of those mean. There's a lovely purport in the seventh canto where, and I can give you the verse in a second here, where Prahlad Maharaj...
That's that famous verse.
Yes, 7.5.23. And Srila Prabhupada in that purport goes through each of those in depth. Of course, so Rupa Goswami also goes through each of those in depth in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And of the 64 angas, they can be categorized according to those nine processes. So some of the 64 angas are going to be categorized under Pratisevanam, some are going to be categorized under Smaranam, and so forth. And they can also be categorized as body, mind, and words. Some of them are mostly body, some of them are mostly mind, some of them are mostly words. And we talked about how Srila Prabhupada gave each of us, gave all of us, we should say, a minimum of following of those 64 angas. That anyone who's my disciple, anyone who's my follower, they have to perform these 64 angas at least to this bottom standard. Chant 16 rounds at least every day, right? Attend the Mangalartik, have a Bhagavatam class every day. So this was the minimum for everybody. And then above and beyond that, it's according to our
desire,
our tastes. Specifically said, one should perform these 64 angas according to one's taste. And this may change over our life also. And that we should be very, very careful of not imposing our taste on others, that this is the only way, you know, everybody. What I like to study 6 hours a day, so you should like to study 6 hours a day. Or I like to study in this way, you should like to study in this way. I get asked frequently, Urmila, how do you study the scriptures? And I don't usually answer that question. I say, well, my way isn't going to work for you. A fascinating time at a ladies' retreat in New Zealand, where the women asked me to give a seminar on how to study Prabhupada's books. So I got everybody in a circle of 20, 25 ladies, and we read around. I said, how do you study Prabhupada's books? And it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating. One woman concentrated on the Sanskrit words in the sloka, and she found other slokas that had those same words. Another person, and I'm not making this up, turned the purports into poetry. Another person turned the purports into questions and answers. Other people like to study with a partner. You know, there was as many varieties of ways to study as there were people in that room. So we talked a bit yesterday about how Krishna is a variety man. He likes variety. He really likes individuality to such an extreme degree that it's almost unfathomable to us. You know, we human beings in the age of Kali, we like sameness. I think this is the opposite of spiritual life. The machine. Stamp out those car parts, make them all the same, you know. Make all the people the same. That's these companies like Monsanto, they want us to have only one kind of corn. You know, Krishna wants us to have 40 kinds of corn. They want everybody to wear this, you know, the same kind of shoes and say the same things and be the same way. They want everyone to have the same kind of chairs and same kind of houses. You go to somebody's housing development, right? And all the houses are the same. So Krishna is exactly the opposite of that. So with Krishna, everything's in harmony. Like in Dwarka, it looked like one designer, because they had designed the whole city, but yet there was all this variety. So now we're going to go on to another kind of variety, and this is the variety of how we serve Krishna according to our body and mind. Because this variety of tastes in the 64 angas, certainly, when we're not very advanced, that variety of taste is going to be, to a greater or lesser degree, a manifestation of our conditioned nature. You know, in my conditioned nature, I'm a musician, so I especially like singing. You know, in my conditioned nature, I'm an artist, so I could. One may like some of the 64 angas because one has a conditioned nature like that. If someone's conditioned nature is they like to travel, so they may particularly like padasevanam, visiting the holy places. And if they weren't traveling to holy places, they'd be traveling, you know, to Alaska and the Panama Canal or something like that. It's really their conditioned nature. As we advance in devotional service, as our real personality starts to manifest, which is what it's supposed to be doing, we're supposed to be awakening our real self, then our tastes in the 64 angas start to be manifestations of who we are eternally. Just like, you know, we read in the literature of the Goswamis, Nanda Maharaj really likes to wear green. Lalita really likes to wear peacock-colored blue. Right? Each of the cowherd boys, they have their favorite food. Even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he's serving the devotees prasadam, he gives them each particularly what they like to eat. You know, again, because we're in this very materialistic culture, we sometimes have this idea that when we become Krishna conscious, we're all going to be exactly the same. And sometimes we try to impose that on our devotees, right? I mean, I just remember one time at a big festival, having a plate of prasadam, looking at one of the other devotees and saying, "This prasadam is wonderful." And she said, "All prasadam is wonderful." So, but the Mahaprabhu's associates, there are certain things they especially like. And Lord Chaitanya would serve them what they like. Krishna does this also. You know, when Mother Yasoda leaves the room, Krishna takes these things off his plate that he knows each cowherd boy likes, and he gives that to them. And Krishna, Lord Kapila Dev says that Krishna takes the form that the devotee likes to worship. And we were saying yesterday, Sanatana Goswami said that each of us is especially attracted to one of the infinite qualities of the Lord. There's infinite jivas, but the Lord has infinite qualities, and we're going to each particularly be related with one of those qualities. So as we progress in devotional service, our attachment to particular parts of the 64 angas will be more and more a manifestation of our actual spiritual nature and our spiritual personality rather than our conditioned personality. And that will be one reason why our taste in devotional service will change over the years. So when we first start practicing Krishna consciousness, there may be certain parts of the 64 angas that just fill us with life and enthusiasm, and 20 years later, that may have shifted somewhat. But there's another part of variety in Krishna consciousness that has nothing at all to do with our spiritual nature. It's completely and totally a manifestation of our conditioned nature, what Prabhupada would call our psychophysical nature. What kind of body we have and what kind of mind we have in this life. And it only has to do with this life, and in fact, some of it has to do just with parts of this life. It's not our real self at all. And in fact, these activities are not bhakti proper. Bhakti proper are the 64 angas, or the 9 processes of bhakti. That's bhakti. These other activities are not in and of themselves bhakti. Prabhupada talks about in 9:30 Bhagavad Gita how we have conditional activities and constitutional activities. Our constitutional activities are hearing, chanting, remembering, serving the lotus feet, being a friend, being a servant, surrendering everything. Our conditional activities are things like brushing our teeth and our particular job and they're not the same. Now, one beauty of the way that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, and Srila Prabhupada in particular are teaching the practice of bhakti yoga is that they're teaching us that we do not have to abandon all of our conditioned activities. That bhakti yoga does not demand abandoning all of one's conditional activities. Now, there does get to be a point in the practice of bhakti yoga. There does get to be a point, as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, when we no longer have any need to do any of our conditioned activities. Nor does Krishna say, do we have any need to give them up? We don't have any need to do them or not do them. We can do them as service, or if Krishna doesn't want, we don't do them as service. However, as long as we're still identifying to any extent with our body and mind, we are going to be forced, Krishna explains to Arjuna, to act according to that nature of the body and mind. We will act according to our identity. And we could speak at great length about how our identity is really the source of all of our decisions. When we decide what we want to do, it's not on the basis of some detached cost-benefit ratio. It's on the basis of our identity. We think, I am this kind of person. Now, what would the idealized form of this kind of person do in this situation? This is how we think. And the people who've discovered this, perhaps not surprisingly, are the advertisers. Advertisers want to know how people think so they can take your money. So they've discovered that people make decisions based on identity. What does a good mother do? What does a good student do? What does a young, hip, single American male do? And when they advertise, they're advertising to identity. That, if you really think about it, this is how we make our decisions. You know, I'm a devotee of Krishna. Okay, what's a devotee of Krishna supposed to do in this circumstance? I'm a member of ISKCON. What does a member of ISKCON do in this circumstance? And that's the basis of our decision-making process. Again, we could get into this in much more depth and give many examples, but we don't have time this evening, so I'm going to ask you to just trust me on this. And if you don't trust me on this, you can email me and I'll send you some source material and you can read the research for yourself. Now, our goal is to identify in a general way as Krishna's servant, and then in a specific way according to who we are. We're supposed to come to the point that we realize, you know, oh, my eternal name is Krishna Das, and I'm one of Krishna's servants, and I polish his flute every day, or whatever our eternal identity is. And then we would make decisions like that. But as long as we're still thinking, you know, I'm Krishna Das, Krishna Dasi in this world, and I've got, you know, what color body do I have? Okay, I got a white body or a brown body or a purple body or whatever, you know, do I have a female body or a male body? Do I have an American body or a Chilean body or a, you know, Brazilian body? Am I married? Am I unmarried? Do I have children? Do I not have children? Am I an artist? Am I a musician? Am I a banker? Am I this? Am I that? As long as we still have those upadis, we are going to act according to those upadis. That's which is very clear to Arjuna. You can't not do that. He said your choices are do it for your selfish purposes or do it for me, Krishna says. And Krishna says, if you do it for your selfish purposes, you'll be lost. And if you do it for me, then you'll have no sin and I will guide you. And the Bhagavad Gita is very clear. When Krishna says sarva dharma and prichaja, he's also saying to Arjuna, right before that, he's saying, Krishna, you're going to fight anyway. If you don't fight for me, you're going to go fight for yourself. You're going to fight for other reasons. And I see on a practical level in our Hare Krishna movement, we have some people who are really into fighting. Now, I'm personally convinced that a lot of those people are frustrated kshatriyas. They don't have anything to govern and they don't have anywhere to fight, so they fight with the other devotees. And some of them, that's not the only reason people fight for other reasons, but some of these people who are always fighting, you'll find they're really into justice and ethics. And, you know, they'll say, I really want fairness and I want justice and I want ethics and I want morality. Well, that's kshatriya. And if you think about it, the only varna we have not facilitated in our Hare Krishna movement are the kshatriyas. Historically speaking, when we first started this country, we facilitated Brahmins and Shudras. You had service to do in the movement. You had a place in the mission, no problem. For various historical and sociological reasons in the late 80s and 90s, we started facilitating Vaishyas. Before that, if you were a Vaishya or Kshatriya, well, you were in Maya. That was all there was to it. But after a while, we started facilitating and activating the Vaishyas. We started saying, hey, if you're a Vaishya, you have a place in Lord Chaitanya's movement, in Prabhupada's movement. We want you. We need you. And you have a way you can use your propensities in service. And we have not yet done that for the kshatriyas. So most of our kshatriyas are either pretending to be something else in the movement, or they're going and doing some kshatriya business outside. Or they're being very frustrated and they're fighting with the devotees and yelling and screaming for justice and fairness and morality and ethics, all of which are the most lacking things also in our Krishna consciousness movement, by the way. You want to know what's really lacking in our Hare Krishna movement? It's care of the devotees, justice and ethics and morality, yes? As we have, because we haven't engaged our kshatriyas. So these are our conditioned activities. And my point is, either you do them for Krishna or you'll do them for illusion. You can't not do them. You cannot not do them until you no longer identify with them at all. Until you only identify with your eternal actual persona. Of course, even then, you may continue to act according to that external nature to set an example for others, or because Krishna wants you to do that as a service, because that's the kind of car you have. You know, once you don't identify with the car anymore, you don't have to drive it anywhere. You don't even have to drive it anywhere for Krishna's service. But you may still do so, even though it's no longer your identity. Is that clear for everybody? Did everybody follow all that?
I was lost on one question.
Yes.
Why act, if we act according to our psychophysical nature, you said that's not bhakti.
Why is that not bhakti proper?
Can it be bhakti?
It can be bhakti if it's in association with bhakti. But it's not bhakti. Although it can act like bhakti. And Prabhupada gives the example of putting the What in the what?
The rod and the fire.
Yes, the high iron rod in the fire. An iron rod is not fire. But if you heat it up, it will act like fire. So most of us don't see hot iron rods put in the fire in our life, unless you go to some sort of demonstration of blacksmithing. But we do see pots put on fire. I assume all of us either cook or walk by the kitchen when someone else is doing so. So we have all seen a pot put on a fire. So a pot is not fire at all. A pot's nature is not fire. But when you put the pot on the fire, anything put into the pot will receive the benefit of the fire. The pot will become as hot as the fire, as long as the pot is on the fire. So our conditional activities are not in and of themselves bhakti at all. Not at all. But when we're performing the 64 angas of bhakti, and we then offer those activities to Krishna, the effect upon us is the same as the effect of performing the 9 processes of bhakti directly. So I'm going to cycle through that again. Those activities are not bhakti, like the pot is not bhakti. But when we have those activities in connection with the process of bhakti and we offer them to Krishna, their effect upon us and their effect upon others is the same as the 9 processes directly, although they are not the 9 processes directly. Is that now?
So brushing our teeth in the morning.
Brushing our teeth in the morning.
You're ready to go chant our japa.
Brushing your teeth is not one of the 64 angas of bhakti. It's not one of the processes of bhakti. But if you're brushing your teeth because you want to make your body fit for devotional service and you're thinking this is Krishna's body, I need to take care of it, and you are also engaged in the process of bhakti proper, you have to have a fire under that pot. If you don't have a fire under that pot, then you're doing something else. You're doing maybe karma yoga, but you're not, even Krishna Karmani, as described in Bhagavad Gita 12.10, working for Krishna, is defined as doing the angas of bhakti without an effort to think of Krishna. Doing the angas of bhakti externally. But it's still the angas of bhakti. Whereas when you're doing your conditional activities and offering them to Krishna, which of course Krishna recommends, yat karoshi yat anasi yat tahosi tadasi yat yat tapasasi pante yat takurushu amadarpana, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer and give away, as well as all austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, is an offering unto me. And Ramananda Roy suggests this to Mahaprabhu as a way to perfection, and Mahaprabhu rejects it. He says that's external. Mahaprabhu doesn't start accepting anything until Ramananda Roy talks about pure bhakti. Bhakti without karma, an addition of karma and an addition of jnana. But we find that Krishna himself, 5,000 years ago, advised Arjuna to do both direct bhakti and offering of his conditional activities, as of course in the modern day does Bhaktivinoda, Bhaktisiddhanta, and of course Srila Prabhupada. This is the Yukta Vairagya principle. Now, one of the main reasons that we're advised to do this is that we have to. Unless you're at a very advanced platform, you have conditional activities. So you have to do something with them. I think this is the most important point, and it's the point of real honesty, that I have this particular nature, I'm going to use it. I'm going to act on it. There isn't an option of I'm not going to act on it. I can't count how many times devotees will say to me, well, I'm just going to give up my nature. And I say, well, according to Bhagavad Gita, you can't. So please stop trying. I mean, hundreds or thousands of times I've had devotees tell me, my nature is just nonsense, my nature is keeping me from Krishna consciousness, I have to give it up and take a different nature. And I say, you can't. That's not your option. Your option is do it in a way that harms you and others, or do it in a way that brings you closer to Krishna. So the main reason that we're being taught to engage our conditional nature is that we don't really have a good option. You can't walk away from it. You can't pretend you don't have it. And the other reason is that we are trying to benefit all of society. And in order to benefit all of society, we want to set an example in society and we want to build a society. And to set an example in society and to build a society, you can't just have people who go off alone in ashrams and just engage in the 9 processes of service and don't interact in the world. Now, there are many places where Srila Prabhupada says that you can do that. technically, theoretically, you can just engage in the 9 processes of devotional service and you don't need to engage in varna and ashram activities. But again, most of us need to do it for ourselves, and we also are doing it as part of our preaching mission. So is that basis now clear? This foundational, philosophical foundation? Okay, let's look at what our conditional activities are. So let's look first at the ashrams. So the ashrams are 4, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. And you can basically divide them into renounced ashrams and householder ashram, although there's still some difference. In the brahmachari ashram, theoretically, shastrically, one is engaged primarily in... What are most of the brahmacharis doing?
Studying.
Brahmachari means a student. Brahmachari means a student. So traditionally, the brahmachari was a child. And one stopped one's brahmachari activity somewhere between 12 and 25 years old. One did not continue in the brahmachari ashram after 24 or 25 years old, except for very, very unusual cases. Just like even in our modern world, most people are not students after 24, 25 years old. Now, some people are lifetime students. Some people get their, you know, MA, PhD, another PhD, an MD, postdoc research, and they never leave the university. They don't even become teachers. They stay as perpetual students. Now, there are people like this, yes? Maybe you've met some. They're constantly doing research and study. Maybe they publish something, but they don't even teach. So that's a very small percentage of the population in our times and in Vedic times. Now, somebody may be a brahmachari whole life in terms of being celibate whole life, but it'd be very unusual that someone stays in the brahmachari ashram their whole life. In the brahmachari ashram, you're a child, and you're treated like a child. Somebody's telling you what to do. Somebody tells you when to wake up. Somebody tells you when to go to bed. You can't even eat unless you're called to eat. Your teacher has to say, come eat. You can't just look at your watch and say it's prasadam time and wander down and get something to eat. You can't have any personal money. Whatever money you collect, you give to your guru. You don't have any personal possessions. Right? In the vanaprastha ashram, the main activity is... Vanaprastha. Traveling to holy places and performing austerities. So these are the main activities in the vanaprastha ashram. The vanaprastha ashram, you give up your occupation. You no longer are making money. So in the modern day, that's people who are retired. They've retired from their work. They're not earning an income anymore. And even in the, you know, ordinary society, people may travel. They don't need to travel to holy places. They travel to Disneyland or something like that. But this concept of giving up working and traveling, and of course the vanaprastha also, like the brahmachari student, gives up sex life. So the vanaprastha is celibate. They're basically renounced sex and money. They're no longer working in the world. And then the sannyas ashram, the main dharma is?
In our
ISKCON society, yes, although the main dharma, according to Bhagavad Gita, is purification of existence and fearlessness. So the sannyasi is basically dead. You're getting free of the fear of death by dying before you die. You know, what we're afraid of at death is I'm going to lose my identity. That's our main fear. I'm going to lose everything I've invested into my relationships and my education and my, you know, this whole identity that I've built up, I have to walk away from. So the sannyasi walks away from that while they're still in this body. And that way, when death comes, there's no fear. And the sannyasi doesn't make practically any effort to maintain themselves and so forth. So the main pleasure in the brahmachari, vanaprastha, and sannyas ashrams is? What is the main pleasure?
Spiritual activities.
These are conditioned activities. These are not constitutional activities. Freedom. Freedom, the main pleasure in the renounced ashram is freedom. That's the main pleasure. And the main sacrifice is that one is not engaged in activities of sense gratification or activities of occupation. So in the renounced ashram, one does not have an occupation. One is not acting in any of the varnas. The brahmachari is preparing for entering into the varnas as a householder. So the brahmachari is learning how they're learning their occupation. But the vanaprastha and the sannyasi are no longer engaged in occupation. They're no longer engaged in occupation. They're no longer out there contributing to the world. They're not using that part of their psychophysical nature. So the vanaprastha and sannyasi particularly, their pleasure is freedom, and their sacrifice is they're no longer engaged in a whole set of conditioned activities. They're no longer engaged in any kind of varna. And one of the ways a person can tell if they're ready for the vanaprastha or sannyas ashram is whether or not they no longer have any interest in engaging in any kind of varna activities. Now, you were saying spiritual activities. It's a fact that a person in the vanaprastha and sannyas ashram especially should be engaged almost exclusively in the 64 angas of bhakti. They shouldn't be engaged very much in conditional activities. That person is really ready to be engaged mostly in constitutional activities. The person in the brahmachari ashram is mixed because they're preparing for the grahastha ashram. So they have to be engaged in the processes of bhakti, and they have to be engaged, as Prabhupada said in the second canto, for getting specific training for their livelihood. So they have to learn both about their varna and about bhakti. Then in the grahastha ashram, what's the main pleasure of the grahastha ashram?
Family life,
sex, gross sex, and subtle sex, and also security. What the grahastha has is security. This is my home, this is my business, this is my husband, this is my wife, this is my children, this is my bank account. And what are the grahastha's sacrifices?
Freedom.
They sacrifice their freedom, yes. The vanaprastha and the sannyasi sacrifice their security. The grahastha sacrifices their freedom. Of course, they can get some freedom by having money. If you have a lot of money, you can have some freedom, but it's still not the same thing. You have to show up for your job, you have to be there maybe to milk the cow, you've got to be there to take care of your wife and your children and so forth and so on. The other sacrifice, of course, the grahastha makes is charity. So they're supposed to give a portion of what they earn to society in general, especially to the brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis, who've given up any means of livelihood. So in this, the ashrams are generally decided by age. If you're under 20, 25, you're probably in the brahmachari ashram. If you're 20, 25 to 50, 55, you're probably in the grahastha ashram. If you're like 50, 55 to 70, 75, you're probably in the vanaprastha ashram. If you're over 75, 80, you're probably ready for the sannyas ashram. Some people will stay in vanaprastha till the end. Sannyas is the only thing that doesn't have a corollary in a materialistic society. Materialistic society has students, family people, and retired people. So mostly what ashram we belong in is according to how old we are. It's actually pretty simple. But it's also according to one's mentality. And one has to see, am I more attached to security or freedom? Please don't try to have both. Please don't try to have both. You know, so one thing that happens in the modern society is people try to have both. They try to have money and the pleasure of the opposite sex while still retaining their freedom, right? They just have some girlfriend or boyfriend. They have a job. They have an apartment. But they never get married. They never have kids. They don't help support the society. They think, let me take all of the happiness of the renounced ashrams without the sacrifice. And let me also take all the happiness of the grahastha ashram without any of those sacrifices. So that's called stealing. So if we're going to offer that part of our life to Krishna, we should do it preferably according to the Shastra. So if we're in the brahmachari ashram, we should be a brahmachari according to Shastra, grahastha according to Shastra, and so forth. We should try as far as possible to avoid making up our own ashrams. You know, well, I'm going to be like Prabhupada called the bachelor dad. You know, he coined that as a term for a made-up ashram. You know, a sannyasi with a bank account and 500 adoring young women. So that's a made-up ashram. That's not a real ashram. You know, or the grahastha who doesn't have an honest occupation, doesn't contribute any charity to society, uses contraceptives to avoid having children. That's a made-up ashram. That's trying to get the happiness without the sacrifice. Now, Krishna's very kind, and you can offer anything to Krishna, in a sense. Like Prabhupada said, if you drink wine, you can meditate on how Krishna's a taste of wine, but you can't offer your wine to Krishna. So if you're going to have some made-up ashram, you can still meditate on Krishna, but you can't offer the ashram to Krishna. Does that make sense to everybody? So if I'm going to offer my ashram situation to Krishna, then I have to perform this. I have to see, what am I enjoying, and what is the proper sacrifice to pay for what I'm enjoying? If I'm not willing to pay that sacrifice, I shouldn't be taking that enjoyment. Pretty simple. Okay, now let's go to the varnas. The varnas are only engaged in the grihastha ashram. The only time of life that one engages in one's varna is in the grihastha ashram, although in the brahmachari ashram, one should be preparing for one's varna. So your varna is, how do you maintain yourself? How do you earn your livelihood? What do you do for an income? And it also deals with, how do you contribute to society? How are you part of the universal form of the Lord, Prabhupada explains. So there's millions and millions and millions of jobs. Prabhupada says in the Nectar of Instruction, he said, in all phases of life, one has to perform devotional activity under the direction of the spiritual master in order to attain perfection in bhakti yoga. It is not that one has to confine or narrow one's activities. Krishna is all-pervading, therefore nothing is independent of Krishna. And Prabhupada also says, as I repeat a lot, this letter to Sukadeva in 1973, Krishna has given everyone something extraordinary, and to serve Krishna with one's extraordinary talent means successful life. And this letter to Karandar in 72, Prabhupada said, there is some symptom of missing the point. The point is to be engaged in doing something for Krishna, never mind what is that job, but being so engaged in doing something very much satisfying to the devotee that he remains always enthusiastic. He will automatically follow the regulative principles because they are part of his occupational duty. By applying them practically as his occupational duty, he realizes the happy result of regulative principles. So there's millions and millions of different occupations, and we can engage any of them in Krishna's service as long as they're not sinful. So you can't be a mafia boss for Krishna. You can't run a slaughterhouse for Krishna. You can't run a prostitution ring for Krishna. You can't run a gambling casino for Krishna. You know, there's really not a whole lot of things that you can't do for Krishna. But some things, you know, you really can't do for Krishna. I mean, I've met some devotees who are working in tobacco companies and gambling casinos, and I said, look, you really got to find another job. So other than things connected with meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling, any occupation can be offered to Krishna. We should find something, as Prabhupada said, which is very much satisfying to the devotee. So this is true not only in terms of the 64 angas of bhakti, but it's also in terms of what is our occupation. What is our occupation? So we find, what is it that makes us feel alive? Ayurveda talks about three basic bodily types, kapha, pitta, vata. And you have different kinds of food for different kinds of people. You know, in modern Western medicine, they don't think like that. They just say, this food is good for everybody, this food is bad for everybody. Of course, they change that assessment every few months. What's good for you, what's bad for you. And Western medicine has one kind of normal. There's one kind of BMI for everybody. You know, and that's it. Increasingly in Western medicine, they're finding that this is not true. That different people have different normals, and different people need to take different medicines according to their genetic makeup, even for the same disease. But Ayurveda has always known this, that the same kind of food can be medicine for one person and poison for another person, depending on our constitutional type. So this is true not only on the bodily level, but also on the psychological level. Each of us has a different kind of psychological food. We each have a different circumstance in which we feel alive or in which we feel imprisoned. So there are certain kinds of work that we go, yes! Just like today I was working on my Govardhan Puja multimedia show, and I had just gotten some new devotional music about Govardhan. So I decided that I was going to replace some of my old music in the show with the new music. And then I decided I was going to add 12 new slides to go with this song from the Gopal Champu about who's lifted Govardhan Hill Oh, the slayer of Putana. Who's worshipping Govardhan Hill? He who's crushed the pride of Kaliya. Who's worshipping Govardhan Hill? He who's given fear to Kamsa. And all that is this wonderful song. So I decided I was going to put in 12 slides, one for each part of the song. Well, there's 10 parts of the song and then two extra in introduction and a little interlude. And so I took the music and I chopped up the piece that I wanted and then I put it in the slideshow and then I figured out how many seconds would be on each slide. And then I put the Sanskrit and the English on each slide, and then I had to find a picture for each slide, and so I was about 7 minutes late to give the class. Why? Because I was so engrossed that I kept thinking, you gotta know what time it is, Ermila. What time is it? Gotta look at the clock. I don't wanna look at the clock. No, you gotta look at the clock. I don't wanna look at the clock. Oh my God, it's 4:45. Am I gonna make it? I'm gonna make it. I'm gonna make it. Okay, just one more thing I gotta get. Oh, this picture of Putin is not good enough. I gotta let. And when I finished, I thought, my God, I love doing this. I absolutely love doing this. I love doing something that's creative and puzzle-solving. And I thought, what's so nice about this is, you know, I make an hour and a half of endeavor, and then I can bring pleasure to hundreds of devotees or thousands of devotees for so many years. You know, as I was doing it, I was thinking of how much the devotees would enjoy seeing it and meditating on Krishna. So I absolutely love doing that. But I was the treasurer in Chicago and I was the treasurer in Boston, and I hated doing that. I hated it. You know, I'd work out the accounts, maybe a few pennies off, and my husband would say, you have to fix it until it's exactly right. I said, it's only 3 cents off. Just leave it. He said, no, you have to find the mistake. And I'd go through and I'd look and I'd look and I'd look. And then I'd find, of course, that the 3-penny mistake was really a $30 mistake. And it would always end up something like that. And finally, I'd get everything to balance. But it was just, I felt like I was trudging uphill through molasses when I did that work. You know, it just wasn't me. So we all have this sort of experience where certain kinds of work we do, it's just, yes, this is my stuff. And other kinds of work we do, we're like, oh, can somebody else do this? And you know whether or not you found your work by how often you look at the clock, by whether or not you even know what time it is, by whether or not you missed a meal without noticing it, by whether or not you find all of a sudden that it's 1 a.m. You know, that's how you know whether or not you found your thing, your element. What are the kinds of things that people can't stop you from doing, that you can do 12, 14, 16 hours a day and you don't want to stop? And as Prabhupada said, you'll naturally follow the regular principles because they're part of your work. I'm doing this for Krishna, I have to do it nicely. And you know what's not your work by the things that are just dragging, that you have to force yourself to do. You may have to make a to-do list, and it's time to do them, and you say, oh, I'll do it in an hour. And you do something else first, and then something else first, and something else first, and something else first. And the whole time you're doing it, you're looking at the clock, and you go eat something even though it's not mealtime, and right? And you go to sleep early, and whatever. You know. So those are the things that are not our nature. Is this clear to everybody? So again, there's millions and millions of different things. And why, I've thought about this a lot, why has Krishna divided them? Why did Krishna take all the millions and divide them into 4 categories? Why couldn't we just leave them as millions? Because the 4 categories tells you that your occupation has a particular type of pleasure and a particular type of sacrifice. And that way you know how to offer it to Krishna. If you can figure out in which of the 4 categories your occupation goes, then you can figure out, okay, how do I sacrifice this for Krishna, and what kind of prasadam am I going to eat? Just like we talked about in the ashrams. The prasadam you eat in the grihastha ashram is security and sense pleasure. The prasadam you eat in the renounced ashrams is freedom. And there's a different kind of sacrifice. Just like different kinds of food, you cook them differently, yes? You don't prepare a cucumber the same way you prepare a zucchini, even though they're cousins. Does that make sense? Do you prepare them a little differently? The taste is different and the preparation is different. So in the different varnas, the taste is different and the preparation is different. So in the Brahmana varna, the main thing you're enjoying is knowledge and truth. The main thing that's moving someone that's pushing someone in the Brahman Varna is a desire for liberation. Again, this freedom component, feeling purified above the modes of nature. And the main sacrifice is your duty to protect truth. It's your duty to protect truth. And how do you do that? You don't take a salary from anybody. You're not under anybody's control. If you're under anybody's control, you're going to change truth to suit the whims of your employer. Just like the modern scientists and philosophers are almost all under in the employ of the government or business. And so they distort the truth. So the main sacrifice, if your enjoyment is liberation and your enjoyment is truth and philosophy, then your main sacrifice is you have to live independently, which means you may have to live very, 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 very simply. And your position is to protect truth at all costs, even your own personal costs. If the truth makes you look bad, doesn't matter, you speak the truth. Then the Kshatriyas, their enjoyment is, I'm helping people. I'm taking care of people. The Kshatriyas are like a great big mommy or a great big daddy. They're supplying for people. They're giving people water and electricity and education and medical care. They're taking care of people. Kshatriyas collect money and redistribute it. They don't generate money. And what really moves a Kshatriya is a feeling that I'm important and I'm honorable and respectful and respectable and I'm righteous. That's the main enjoyment in the Kshatriya Varna. I'm a good person. I do the right thing. I'm moral. I'm ethical. I'm just. And I take care of people. I make sure that people have what they need. Then the sacrifice is you've got to take care of people in such a way that they come to Krishna. You can't just give them food and water and education. You have to engage them in yajna. And you also have to be submissive to the brahmanas. So although the kshatriya has this mood of I'm the big cheese, still they have to be listening to the brahmanas who are going to guide them in truth. And the kshatriyas have to not want to control the brahmanas. They're controlling the rest of society, but they don't control the brahmanas. So again, the kshatriyas are protecting primarily people. The brahmins are protecting primarily truth. Kshatriyas are protecting primarily people. Then the vaishyas really want to enjoy wealth and opulence. And the vaishyas, their sacrifice is they're supposed to protect the sources of wealth, the natural resources, and the animals. The vaishyas also are supposed to generate honest wealth, not just numbers on a screen. So they're supposed to generate honest wealth from natural resources and animals and protect the natural resources and animals and use them for Krishna. Then the main thing the shudras want is immediate pleasure and relief from immediate pain. The shudras don't care so much about getting a lot of money, nor do they care about getting a lot of power and reputation, nor do they care about getting a lot of freedom. They just kind of want to be happy now. And what the shudra sacrifice is protecting the arts and the skills. Just like in our modern society, we were saying earlier, everything's factory done. The arts and the skills are all being lost. So the shudras are supposed to protect the arts and the skills and have them connected again to the spiritual, that the dance, the music, the art, the theater, the furniture, the cooking utensils, everything should be such that it's honoring the material resources and honoring Krishna. So that is their sacrifice. The sacrifice the sutras use is to have pious pleasures, to have pleasures that will connect them with Krishna. So the brahmanas protect truth, the kshatriyas protect people, the vaishyas protect the natural resources and the animals, and the sutras protect the arts and the skills and the things. And in turn, they each get their prasadam, that the shudras get beautiful sense pleasures, the vaishyas get wealth, the kshatriyas get reputation and power, and the brahmins get freedom. So you can see again, you know, each of the millions of occupations can fit into one of those categories. Sometimes they're sort of on the cusp. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get into this in depth. But whatever occupation one has, one should think in terms of, what is it I want to enjoy? And please be honest here. If we're dishonest and we say, no, I don't want to enjoy anything, then we'll try to enjoy it anyway. We'll just do it separately from Krishna and we'll cause havoc. So if we're honest and say, I'm still identifying as a material being to some extent, And to whatever extent I'm still identifying as a material being, I have certain things that I like to taste. I have certain things I like to enjoy. And certain things I don't like. So those things that I want to enjoy, let me offer them to Krishna, and then I can enjoy the result as prasada. And this is very nicely explained by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati in his commentary on Brahma Samhita, text 61. That one offers one's activity a sacrifice, and then one can enjoy that activity that one loves as prasada. At a certain point, for most of us, we give that up. And we say, okay, now I'm just engaging, other than basic things like brushing your teeth, now I'm just engaging in the nine processes of bhakti. Now I'm no longer engaging in conditioned activities, unless Krishna wants me to, for some service. Now, of course, in all these ways of sacrifice, we should be sacrificing not just for Krishna, but for Srila Prabhupada's mission. And we should see, how can I take this thing I love, this thing I want to enjoy, this thing I'm naturally good at, how can I use this in Srila Prabhupada's mission, in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission? And how can I sacrifice in such a way that I am pleasing Krishna and pleasing the devotees? And then going way back to the beginning, how can I do this with this feeling of affection for Krishna, for my guru, and for the devotees? We then have a harmonious society as far as possible in the Kali Yuga. It's not going to be 100% possible. But as far as possible, we have a harmonious society. And where we all give up these upadis, sarvapadi, vinimuktam, tatpartam, namala, rishikesha, rishikesha, sevana, bhakti, rishite, and really come to just wanting to satisfy the senses of Rishikesh. If we manage our societies like this, that everyone has some baseline things they have to do, everybody has to clean, you know, like everybody has to brush their teeth, everybody has to help clean the temple, everybody has to, you know. You can't say, well, that's not my occupation, Prabhu. Like I once met a devotee who said, I know I'm a Brahmin because I never want to do any physical work. You know, well, that's a bunch of nonsense. And you meet some of these caste Brahmins like this in India. There's one school that is associated with our movement where one of our Western devotees suggested to some of the teachers that, well, you could have the children help you clean the classroom after school. She was asked to leave the school and never return. Why? Because the teacher she had spoken to was a caste Brahmana who said, I never clean the room. That's only for the Shudras. So just like all of us, whatever we're doing, we have to brush our teeth, we have to take a shower. So all of us, whatever we're doing, we should also be contributing to the basic menial work of having this movement go on. None of us should ever think we're too good for menial service. At the same time, we should be engaged in bhakti according to our taste, and we should be engaged in our vana and ashram according to our age and our taste, and help engage other people that way. And trust that if we do that, Krishna will send the people to fill in the gaps. Because if we're engaging people according to their propensities, everybody's going to be very happy. And if everybody's very happy, then people are going to come like anything. Because even out in the world, if you engage according to your taste and your nature, if you're not offering it to Krishna, it's not going to be ultimately satisfying. It's not going to be ultimately meaningful. We're the only ones who can offer meaningful service to anybody. No matter how much you fit materially with your psychophysical nature, that's not ultimately satisfying. Prabhupada says here, satisfying to the devotee, what's ultimately satisfying is when I'm who I am and I'm offering it to Krishna. Ultimately, spiritually, when I find out who I am, I'm such and such cow, I'm such and such gopi, I'm such and such cowherd boy, and I offer that to Krishna. But even the who I am in the temporary illusion, even who I am in the drama, to find out who I am and offer that to Krishna. And we're the only ones who can offer that. Nobody else can offer that. I'm not saying just Honolulu, ISKCON, but you know, only those who follow this philosophy given by Krishna can offer this, facilitate. So certainly we should do that. So I need to end now because we're supposed to go on Harinam Sankirtan. So I apologize that I'm really trying to give like 10 hours worth of information in 50 minutes. I'm sure there's tons of questions, but hopefully we've discussed enough so that you have a start and you can go on from there. And if by trying to do things very fast I've skipped something important or distorted something, please forgive me. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.